Welcome to the CSIS Cogit Asia podcast, where we think deeply and reflect on policy in Asia. I'm your host, Colm Quinn. We'll start as we always do with the region's news. In Seoul, the South Korean government announced that the leaders of Japan, China and South Korea will meet on Sunday, November 1st in what will be the first trilateral summit between the three countries in over 3 years. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and South Korean President Park Geun-hye will hold their first one-on-one meeting. Abe will also meet with Chinese Premier Li Keqiang to discuss a range of bilateral issues in Sino-Japanese relations. In Delhi, the Indian policy and business community spent the week mulling India's slow progress in enhancing its business environment following the release of the World Bank's annual Ease of Doing Business report. This year's report ranks India at 130th in the world, an improvement by 12 spots from the previous year, but also highlights the immense remaining challenges for improving governance. In the South China Sea, the US Navy sent a guided missile destroyer on a freedom of navigation operation to steam inside the 12 nautical mile zone of a Chinese-built artificial island in the Spratly Islands for the first time. And that's the news. This week, our first featured topic is the US Navy's Freedom of Navigation operation that we mentioned earlier. Bonnie Glazer, director of CSIS's new China Power Project, sat down with my colleague and CSIS Asia Policy blog editor Jeff Bean to analyze the operation and China's reaction.
Hi, I'm Jeff Bean, editor of the CSIS Asia Policy blog. I'm joined today by Bonnie Glazer, senior advisor for Asia and director of the China Power Project here at CSIS. Bonnie, I want to talk to you about an event that happened yesterday on October 27th. The United States Navy sent a destroyer along with two aircraft to transit through the 12 nautical mile area of a Chinese-built artificial island in the South China Sea. This one's called Subi Reef. Bonnie, why is the United States conducting these operations, these freedom of navigation operations or FONOPs in the South China Sea?
Well, the United States has been conducting freedom of navigations around the world for many, many decades. In fact, in 1979, a program was established to ensure that there is freedom of the sea. So the United States was essentially asserting the right of all navies in the world to transit through waters that are the high seas, that are not part of the sovereign maritime territory of another nation. So when China built these artificial islands, and particularly this one on Subi Reef, Subi used to be a submerged feature at high tide. And under the convention, the law of the sea, a submerged feature, even if it is made into a large artificial island, is not entitled to have a 12 nautical mile territorial sea, which if it had been a rock that had protruded above the water, then it would have been entitled to those 12 nautical miles. Now, the Chinese have not explicitly claimed a territorial sea. They have been deliberately ambiguous. There have been statements by the Chinese foreign ministry that suggest that they have made claims. And the Chinese have also warned away U.S. aircraft that have flown near these artificial islands, suggesting that they have that these U.S. aircraft should go away from China's military alert zone. And that has been undefined. So it really does appear that the Chinese are asserting some rights over territorial waters. And it also looks like that the Chinese want to assert greater control over the sea and airspace, possibly within their entire nine-dash line claim in the South China Sea. So the Obama administration has been deliberating whether or not to conduct a FONOP, or Freedom of Navigation operation, inside the 12 nautical miles around one of these formerly submerged features since early May, when it was reported by the Wall Street Journal. And the U.S. Navy has wanted to do this for some time. I think there's been a considerable debate within the administration as to whether or not this would advance U.S. Interests and the objective of convincing China to rely more on diplomacy, to lower tensions with its neighbors, rather than engage in coercive activities and use these artificial islands for primarily military purposes. So I think that after many months of dithering, that the Obama administration decided that the time was now right to go ahead and do this. And I should underscore that this freedom of navigation operation was not intended to challenge Chinese sovereignty claims over Subi Reef or any other island. The United States maintains a neutral position on the question of sovereignty. And it was not intended to be a provocation or a hostile act. It was just intended to assert the right of navies around the world to travel through waters that are open to the international community under the Convention on the Law of the Sea.
From a practical standpoint, what does an operation like this entail for the destroyer and for the Navy?
Well, a freedom of navigation operation usually is more than just passing from point A to point B, that is, just going through the 12 nautical miles. Usually there's an activity that is conducted, or the Navy ship, and in this case the aircraft, will loiter inside the 12 nautical miles. So in this case, there has not been any briefing that has been given by the Pentagon about exactly what took place. All we've seen are background statements from Pentagon officials and some deliberate leaks to let the world know through the media that this has taken place. So my understanding is that the ship entered from the north, went through the 12 nautical miles, exited in the southwest, did loiter for a considerable period of time around Subi Reef. There was a P-3 aircraft as well as a P-8 aircraft. These are surveillance aircraft that accompanied the destroyer. In addition, and I think this is very important, as part of this FONOP, the U.S. also entered into the waters near a Philippine-occupied island and a Vietnamese-occupied island. So this was to signal that the United States is not trying to point a finger solely at China. And indeed, you can go on the Pentagon's website and you can find a list of the countries around the world that the United States targets for such freedom of navigation operations. And it includes many U.S. allies and partners, security partners. So every claimant in the South China Sea that occupies territory, including Malaysia, Philippines, Vietnam, and Taiwan, as well as China, have all been targets of such freedom of navigation operations.
And the timing of this so soon after Xi Jinping's visit here in Washington to meet with President Obama, why do you think the United States waited until after the summit to go forward, and why now in October ahead of EAS and APEC?
Well, I think that in the run-up to the Xi Jinping visit, there were many discussions about the South China Sea, and there really was no narrowing of the differences between U.S. and Chinese officials. The Chinese consistently said that these islands are Chinese territory, that China does not block freedom of navigation. But again, the Chinese are very ambiguous about what their claims are and what their jurisdiction is. And they have been interfering in some ways with U.S. aircraft and that have operated in the South China Sea. So I think the expectation was that during Xi Jinping's visit that there would be no progress on this issue. I think that the U.S. didn't want to completely sour the atmosphere of the visit by conducting the FONOP in the run-up to the visit. So my guess is that a decision was made to go ahead after the visit. Surprisingly, Xi Jinping, in his press conference with President Obama, mentioned that China does not intend to militarize the South China Sea. That was not said, as I understand it, in the private conversations with President Obama, and so U.S. officials heard this for the first time at the press conference. And in the aftermath of that statement, there have been efforts to understand what did Xi Jinping mean by this statement? How did the Chinese conceptualize the concept of not militarizing the South China Sea? What does militarization mean? And my understanding is that the Chinese themselves are scratching their heads trying to figure out what their leader Xi Jinping meant by this. But it doesn't look like the Chinese have in any way slowed down their construction on these islands, which includes 10,000-foot runway now completed on Fiery Cross, another runway being built on Mischief Reef and on Subi Reef as well. It looks like there are hangars for aircraft, radars that are being installed. Our Pacific Commander, Admiral Harry Harris, has talked publicly about the growing evidence that China is, in fact, militarizing these islands. So I think that it was concluded after Xi Jinping's visit was the right time to demonstrate to China that the United States is going to continue to defend the freedom of navigation in these waters, and to reassure the countries in the region that the United States will continue to be an important protector and guarantor of peace and stability in the region.
And now, over the last couple of days, what reactions had first off took place as the operation was underway or immediately after the operation concluded from China? And second, has the government said anything?
Well, in the run-up to this freedom of navigation operation, because of the media attention, the Chinese were very well prepared. And because this had been discussed for 6 months in the open press, they had time to prepare their statements as well as how the Navy would react. My understanding is that there were several Chinese naval ships that were shadowing the USS Lassen, which was the destroyer that was engaged in this FONOP. And so they were monitoring it and shadowing it as it sailed around the South China Sea and as it entered the 12 nautical miles around Subi Reef. Nobody has made public what distance the Chinese Navy maintained, but my guess is that the Chinese do not want to have an accident of any kind with a U.S. military ship. So my guess is that it kept a substantial distance, but nevertheless was signaling the United States that it was present. There were some communications that were apparently made, although it's not clear if it came from those Navy ships or from somewhere else, that warned the USS Lassen to get out of the area around the islands. But China is always careful. They don't use the term territorial sea. And indeed, there were tough statements issued by both the foreign ministry and the defense ministry of the Chinese government. These statements claimed that the United States was acting in a destabilizing way in the South China Sea, that the U.S. operation was illegal, was contrary to UNCLOS and China's domestic law. This is probably a reference to the 1992 Chinese territorial law, which seems to suggest that all Chinese territory gets a 12 nautical mile territorial sea. So they were harsh statements. And in addition, the Chinese foreign ministry called in U.S. Ambassador to China Max Baucus to deliver a demarche or a protest. I would guess that the Chinese will continue through their pundits in the media, for example, to criticize the U.S. action. One of the negative consequences of this, which is unfortunate but I think necessary, the Chinese will say that the United States has proven that it is militarizing the South China Sea and that that justifies what the Chinese are doing. And when I'm asked this by reporters, what I respond is that the U.S. restraint over the last year and a half, while China has been building these artificial islands, has certainly not been responded to by the Chinese by any slowdown in what they are doing. So U.S. inaction perhaps has emboldened China to engage in this fast-paced effort to build up military capabilities in the South China Sea. I believe that the demonstration of U.S. will to engage in these FONOPs will be part of a strategy, one tool in our toolbox, and we have to do much more, to try and alter China's calculus that the costs of engaging in this buildup, in violating international law, and potentially making a very large claim to waters in the South China Sea, and coercing its neighbors, these do not serve Chinese interests. So the hope is that China over time will recognize that lowering tensions with its neighbors, engaging in serious talks on a code of conduct for the South China Sea with ASEAN, that this is really the best way to go.
You talked about the U.S. demonstrating its resolve and the strategy that it's going to pursue. What, in your view, are the implications for stability in the South China Sea, given that it is such a key waterway moving forward?
Well, there is always the potential for an accident between U.S. and Chinese forces, such as we saw in the tragic incident in 2001 when a Chinese fighter jet collided with a U.S. surveillance plane. But the U.S. and China have now put in place a memorandum of understanding that is aimed at ensuring operational safety when naval surface ships encounter each other or when aircraft come into close proximity. I believe that those will be a potentially stabilizing factor. But I think that these operations by the United States are going to become the new normal in the South China Sea. Conducting one FONOP is not sufficient. This has to be done repeatedly to ensure that the Chinese understand that the United States is going to preserve the right to transit through international waters. So for some time, the Chinese, if these things are reported publicly, the Chinese will respond publicly. But either way, they will shadow U.S. forces when they do this. And that's where the potential is if there is a particularly aggressive operator on a Chinese ship or potentially in a fighter jet, then that's where the danger is that there could be an accident. But I expect that the sides will be careful, that the Chinese will adjust to this new normal in the South China Sea, and hopefully over time will factor this into their own calculation about how to best advance Chinese interest in the region and, again, rely more on diplomacy going forward than on the military tools that they are using in the South China Sea.
Bonnie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeff.
And that was Bonnie Glaser. Now we turn to the Washington visit of Indonesian President Joko Widodo, better known as Jokowi. President Obama and Jokowi met this week to discuss expanding security and economic cooperation between the United States and Indonesia. SMUCHO Chair for Southeast Asia Studies Ernie Bauer joined Jeff Bean to discuss the key takeaways from the summit.
My name is Jeff Bean, editor of the CSIS Asia Policy Blog. I'm joined today by Ernie Bauer, SMUCHO Chair and Senior Advisor here at CSIS. We want to discuss the visit earlier this week of Indonesian President Jokowi Widodo, goes by Jokowi. Ernie, what did President Obama and President Jokowi discuss in their meeting at the White House earlier this week?
The leaders of the second and third largest democracies in the world really dug into their bilateral relationship, and they talked about security, cooperation, economic relations. And very significantly, Jeff, they increased they stepped up the U.S.-Indonesia relationship from what had been sort of a platform called the Comprehensive Partnership to a strategic partnership, which is a very significant departure for the Indonesians from a studied history of non-aligned foreign policy that dates back to the country's founder, Sukarno, who was a founder of the Non-Aligned Movement.
And in terms of specific agreements on defense and maritime cooperation, what did the United States commit to?
Well, the United States has been working with countries around Southeast Asia to help them and enhance their maritime domain awareness and modernize and professionalize the militaries. You know, we lost a decade with the Indonesians due to human rights concerns over East Timor and Aceh years ago. But now we've normalized the defense relationship with Indonesia. And Indonesia has real interests and concerns about its security. Increasingly, it's worried about China. China has the Nine Dash Line tips the Natuna Sea, which is Indonesian territory where a lot of their gas and oil resources lie. And Chinese warships have penetrated the Sunda, Lombok, and Malacca Straits without any notice to the Indonesians, which has really alarmed the Indonesian Navy and the military in particular, but also Indonesian citizens. And I think the other area where the United States and Indonesia will be working even more closely together is on counterterrorism. Indonesians have seen an increase from the time when they saw some Indonesians go to Afghanistan years ago. Now Indonesian fighters who have gone to fight with the Islamic State, the numbers are as much as five times as many as they saw go to Afghanistan. And remember that when those fighters returned and an increasingly radicalized, very small segments of Indonesian society, which we could consider radical Islamists, it did result in two very deadly bombings, one in Bali and one in Jakarta at the Marriott Hotel.
And what did Presidents Jokowi and Obama focus on the trade and investment and economic side? Why do you think President Jokowi chose this moment to announce that Indonesia will consider joining TPP or would like to join the Trans-Pacific Partnership down the road?
Yeah, in Asia, economics is really the foundation of securities. I think the Indonesians are dialing into that fact. And so there's some level of the geopolitical argument for joining TPP to get aligned based on some of the security concerns that I mentioned earlier. I think also economically, it's clear to Jokowi and Indonesia that the TPP will bend supply chains, global supply chains, towards its members and also change FDI, foreign direct investment trend lines, towards members. And Indonesia needs to be part of that global supply chain. They need the investment. And so I think Jokowi also felt comfortable saying that he would join TPP because he knows he's got some time. You know, the aperture to for new members to join won't open certainly until the agreement is done, and that could be as many as a year or two. So he's got time to prepare for this. And we know that Jokowi is trying to implement economic reforms in Indonesia, and he will use the TPP at a later time as an exogenous lever to drive those reforms.
And of course, it was reported in the news this week and mentioned a little bit that Jokowi had to leave early. He was planning to stop in Silicon Valley in San Francisco. There is a domestic crisis which he was required to respond to with the ongoing forest fires and haze problem throughout Indonesia and affecting some of its neighbors in Southeast Asia. How do you think this early departure was received in the U.S., particularly among the business community?
Like a lot of leaders, Jokowi is, his first priority is at home. He's a year into his term, as a 5-year term as president. I would say his priority is trying to get the politics at home right. He's got some competition for power within his own party, within his own government, and with the forest fires that are burning, or the plantation fires that are burning in Jakarta, burning in Indonesia. I think that those fires have and the haze that has resulted from them have become one of the world's top environmental disasters of this year. You know, the estimates are that the impact on climate change could be potentially bigger than all of the United States emissions over the course of an entire year, just in the last couple months. So he went home as the haze, the winds turned and the haze started to push towards Java, the most populated island in Indonesia, to manage that crisis. And I think it underlines the fact that, like any good leader, but certainly one with a leader of a populous, extremely large democracy, you better cover your home base or you won't have an ability to do anything in terms of foreign affairs and trade. And I think that's why Jokowi went home.
And that was Ernie Bauer. Now on to our one to watch. Staying with the Halloween theme for this week, we look at the Sea of Trees, a mysterious forest in Japan. Readers of the Telegraph newspaper recently voted the Aokigahara Forest in Japan as one of the world's scariest places. The forest, located at the base of the iconic Mount Fuji, has dense foliage due to tight clusters of hemlock fir and Japanese cypress, which block out wind and sound over a 14-square-mile area, in turn making navigation difficult. Worryingly, the forest has become one of the world's most well-known destinations for suicide attempts. Signs at the entrance to the park encourage visitors to contact their loved ones or a 24-hour hotline. The forest also represents a special home for demons, according to Japanese mythology, perhaps because it is formed on lava fields following an ancient volcanic eruption. Hollywood has caught on to the forest's spooky qualities. A horror film titled The Forest, set in the Aokigahara and featuring actress Natalie Dormer, comes out in January. That's our show for this week. You can always find more at cogitasia.com and csis.org. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and also check out our island tracker and maritime specific analysis on the Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative, or AMTI, microsite. I'm Colm Quinn. Happy Halloween and thanks for listening.